Deutsche Welle, Living Planet. This week on Living Planet, who should take the lead in the fight to keep global temperatures down?
We definitely believe that nations that have profited from a world without carbon constriction should lead the way in terms of ambition.
Migratory birds are making their way north and they've gone high tech.
Last autumn, electronic tracking devices were attached to the bodies of 18 of these pelicans. The device sends scheduled SMS messages via satellite transmitters.
And we take a low-carbon trip straight across the Atlantic Ocean.
As a passenger on a cargo ship, you are burning no extra fuel at all to get across the ocean. For my trip from Brazil, that's a saving of 786 kilograms of CO2, in comparison to making a flight.
I'm Saroja Coelho. Welcome to the show. The latest round of climate talks have come to a close here in Bonn. More than 1,000 participants, including delegates from 176 countries, were here to continue the discussion about a treaty to succeed Kyoto. Now, the Kyoto Protocol is a global agreement intended to curb emissions from greenhouse gases, but it expires in just 7 years. We caught up with Andres Pirazzoli, a negotiator with the Chilean delegation. Here's his take on the latest round of talks.
The session was quite positive. We were able to be more open, be more frank.
Now, the delegates were also tasked with addressing the needs of nations most affected by climate change. Developing nations are likely to pay the highest price for the effects of global warming. They are losing land to rising tides and desertification. They are seeing vast deforestation as well as the loss of biodiversity. And they're also affected by extreme weather. But the problem here is that, for the most part, developing nations don't get any of the benefits of the industrial activity that caused the damage in the first place. One of the dividing issues at this round of talks was whether global powers should focus on stopping climate change or concentrate on helping nations already affected. Leading industrial nations want the world to concentrate on reducing greenhouse gas production rather than focusing mostly on adaptation strategies. Pirazzoli explained why.
Because they feel that developing countries should, that growing economies, you know, emerging economies, are emitting more and will be quite soon almost equal in terms of the share. So they think that mitigation should be the actual focus, and that's their main concern.
But Pirazzoli explained that while he understands this position, both poor and rich nations have a role to play. He said the Chilean delegates want to see wealthy nations lead by example.
We definitely believe that nations that have profited from a world without carbon constriction should lead the way in terms of ambition.
The talks were part of a lead-up to a major climate conference in Paris in 2015. It's hoped that there a new global deal on climate protection can be signed. Now, something interesting that Pirazzoli touched on was that China has now overtaken the United States as the world's biggest producer of carbon dioxide. So getting both nations to agree on a new global climate pact will be a major challenge in the lead up to the talks in Paris.
There's this game between the U.S. and China where none of them is going to move first. So they're both waiting for the other one to move first. And in the meantime, temperature is rising. People in China are suffering. People in the U.S. are suffering. We saw Sandy the other day. We see what happens in the coastal areas of the U.S., the coastal areas of China. Food is going to be a big issue for Chinese people.
Pirazzoli thinks China and the U.S. have important roles to play and that a little good-natured competition could inspire the rest of the world to heighten their efforts.
What I would like to see is these two group of nations trying to overplay each other. So trying to be more ambitious and show more competitiveness, that would raise the bar, definitely.
The delegates will be back at the table in a few weeks. We'll continue to follow their progress for you here on Living Planet.
I'm not afraid to die.
Estelle there with her hit Do My Thing. You're listening to Living Planet. I'm your host, Saroja Coelho. May 11th marks World Migratory Bird Day. Scientists are hard at work to understand the mysteries of this global movement of birds from north to south and back again. And in our next report, we take to the skies with the great white pelican. This large, graceful bird has a broad wingspan and long body, and it can weigh as much as 13 kilograms. And what the pelican is really famous for is its throat pouch. That's that long, elastic bag at the bottom of its mouth, which it uses to scoop up fish. The great white pelicans migrate from Europe to Africa in the fall so they can spend their winters in a warmer climate. Now it's spring here in Europe, and the great white pelican is on its way back to its breeding grounds in the north. And on this long journey, the pelican stops for a rest in Israel. Flocks touch down in salt marshes and fish ponds, and they spend a few days eating and preparing for the rest of their flight. Their stopover gives scientists in Israel an opportunity to study their movements. And as part of this, they've equipped the great white birds with some 21st century technology. Vanessa O'Brien has this report.
Every weary traveller needs a hiatus before the next leg of their journey. A place to rest, recoup, and restore their depleted energy levels. For the 50,000 white pelicans making their annual return from the marshlands of Sudan to Southeast Europe and Asia, that place is here in northern Israel. They are returning in huge flocks right now, making their distinctive honking call. Today, Ohad Hatzafeh, an avian ecologist, is their one-man welcoming committee. They've flown some 2,400 kilometres or 1,500 miles to get here. Ohad heads up a team of five full-time staff from Israel Nature Parks and Authority and the Society for the Protection of Nature. They work around the clock during the pelican's migration. They race from location to location, tracking arrivals, departures and feeding locations. But now they have an extra tool at their disposal. Last autumn, electronic tracking devices were attached to the bodies of 18 of these pelicans. The device sends scheduled SMS messages via satellite transmitters. In addition to revealing where the birds are, the device also details what the bird is doing and how healthy it is. With an average body weight of 6 to 8 kilograms and a wingspan of about 3 meters, these pelicans are one of the world's largest migratory birds. They hardly notice the extra 100-gram tracking device strapped to their bodies, says Ohad.
If I open now my computer, I will get SMS messages directly to my Outlook, and then I can calculate and understand where they are, what altitude they are flying, which speed they are flying, and this helps us to find them around, to get the data, because these are data loggers, and there is data that tells us also the activity, if they are standing, flying, swimming, and so on, that we can analyze from it. So we need to know their position in order to get near them.
It's hoped that this intensive monitoring will give scientists a clearer picture of the pelican's migration pattern and the challenges they face on their journey. Increased desertification and dwindling food resources on their traditional route means that the pelicans often arrive in Israel starving hungry. And there is a new problem here too. Israel's traditional food sources for the pelicans are drying up. Lake Tiberias in the north has been overfished and the Hula Valley swamplands drained. It's creating a big headache for commercial fish breeders who can easily lose thousands of dollars a day when large flocks of hungry pelicans descend on their ponds, eating 1 to 2 kilograms of fish each. Now Israel Parks and Nature Authority is partnering with commercial fisheries to buy undersized and underweight fish and put them in park reservoirs to attract the pelicans away from commercial fishing areas, says Ohad.
Only if we create an alternative to them, it will reduce the damage or the dependency of those pelicans on the fish stocks. So they provide us the fish with a cost or sometimes even for free. And they want us just to keep the pelicans, to attract them off their fish ponds.
Pelicans are protected by law in Israel, which is a member of the United Nations Environment Programme and a signatory of the African-Eurasian Waterbird Agreement. So while it's now illegal for fish farmers in Israel to shoot the birds, they use a combination of fireworks, netting and guards to scare them away. Some fish farmers believe that by providing the pelicans with low-quality fish, OHAD's team is just encouraging them to stay. OHAD disagrees.
So without it, they would stay here. Whether they would die or they would winter. In both cases, we don't want it. We don't want them to die here. They are protected by the Israeli law, by international conventions. And if they'll stay here, until they die all winter time, still they feed on fish. And if they feed on fish and they can't find it in the natural habitat, which means that it's to feed on fisheries. To feed on fisheries, it's damage to the fisheries. Damage to the fisheries, then they'll be hunted or chased by fishermen.
This is where the tracking devices come in handy. The Hebrew University is collating all the information gathered and carrying out scientific and methodological research to determine how the birds are meeting their nutritional needs. Yoav Barton is a scientist involved in collecting the research. He says the research is still in its early stages, but the results are promising.
It's very significant. I mean, this is, again, people have asked these questions many times, and we could answer these questions only by very anecdotal data and very indirect data. We are actually starting from scratch. We can answer now better.
There was some previous GPS data, but the resolution was too low to be useful. Now Yoav can open up his tracking screen on his laptop, select a pelican, and identify exactly where it's located. The data has already identified a previously unknown nesting habitat for the travelling pelicans in Lake Eber in Turkey. Yoav is still waiting on 7 pelicans to begin their migration from South Sudan and onto Europe via Israel. Eager for the data from their journey, he says he might send them an SMS to hurry them up.
They do have a transmitter with a GSM, so maybe we can call them.
Finer details about the information gathered so far from the Pelican SMS project is expected after the pelicans finish their migration north this spring, when the data will be collated. Only then will scientists know whether the alternative feeding plan created by the Israel Nature and Parks Authority is really working. The data will also give them a greater insight into what is one of the most unique phenomena in the natural world, the long-distance migration of one of the world's largest birds. Vanessa O'Brien, DW, Northern Israel.
We're going to take another long journey now, but this time, instead of flying, we're boarding a cargo ship. Now, traveling on a cargo ship might make you think of swinging in a hammock or swabbing the decks, but actually, it's quite a comfortable alternative to flying. Now, depending on where you're headed, it can take weeks to reach your destination, but it's a low-carbon way to travel. Prepare to set sail as DW correspondent Ben Knight takes us across the Atlantic Ocean from Brazil to Germany.
It's 11 p.m. and I'm in the port of Fortaleza on Brazil's northern coast aboard the Aristote. The Aristote is a mid-sized freighter, about 170 meters long, operated by the French company CMA-CGM. According to the passenger's booklet in my cabin, CMA-CGM is the world's third biggest container shipment company. The banging you can hear in the background is the loading and unloading of huge metal containers, each one the size of a truck. There are close to 1,700 of them, and the operation will apparently take the rest of the night and at least until 5 p.m. tomorrow, or 1,700 hours as we old sea dogs like to say. A day later, and we've set sail. This is honestly the most exciting trip I've ever taken. For many reasons, but mainly because Sergei, the Ukrainian second officer, has just shown me the bridge. It is everything I dreamed of. Huge radar screens, large slanted windows looking out on all sides, a sliding stick to make the engine go, and, oh yes, big high driver seats in front of banks of instruments, just like the ones in Star Trek. The bridge gives you a vast panoramic view through almost 360 degrees of ocean, and when the ship is out at sea, the second and third officers rotate navigation duties in 4-hour shifts. Sergei explains.
I have to steer the con the vessel to check the situation around, if there is some vessel and there is a close quarter situation, I have to alter course and what else? In charge of checking the vessel's position then what I have to do also here, check the alarm systems, that all equipment is in good working order.
I wonder if it's annoying having geeky passengers hanging around asking him questions all the time.
It's not so big problem. If they don't touch on some electronic devices, not pushing some red buttons, that's normal.
For me at least, all this is a lot more exciting than the cockpit of a plane, which you're not even allowed into these days anymore anyway. Few people even realise that you can travel as a passenger on cargo freighters, but it's a niche service offered by most shipping companies. It does require a lot more paperwork than jumping on a plane. Medical certificates, yellow fever immunisation, insurance that covers emergency helicopter rescue, etc, etc. But once you're on board, it's serene five-star service all the way. Three meals a day in the officer's mess, coffee whenever you want it on the bridge, a seawater swimming pool, and sometimes you even get to enjoy the odd dolphin sighting. The captain of my ship is Georgi Dubikov, another Ukrainian. In fact, though the company is French and the Aristote is an Irish-owned ship with a UK flag, all 23 crew members are either Ukrainian or Filipino. Captain Dubikov says that after 6 months at sea, it's good to have the extra company, but passengers also give him something else to worry about.
We need to supervise all-time passengers. Tell them, do not go there, be careful there, because this is cargo vessel, yes. It's the people working every day with on deck, they welding, they chipping, they painting, so it's a little bit other story with passenger vessel.
In other words, don't stand at the front of the ship and do the Titanic thing and pretend you're flying. Indeed, Captain Dubikov specifically warned me against doing this. But that's unlikely, as there is only one other passenger I could share the Hollywood moment with. And he's a retired Swiss high school teacher called Ernst Steingruber. This is his second trip on a cargo vessel, something he's always wanted to do.
In my job, I had lots of stress sometimes with the colleagues and with the pupils. And then I sometimes said in the staff room, when I'm going on pension, I'm going to go for a trip with a cargo ship to get peace and quiet and go slow. So, and then my colleagues, they gave me a ticket to go with a cargo vessel. And then that's why I went last year from Martinique to France.
The other advantage, of course, is the environmental impact. As a passenger on a cargo ship, you are burning no extra fuel at all to get across the ocean. For my trip from Brazil, that's a saving of 786 kilograms of CO2, in comparison to making a flight. It might be a lot more time-consuming, but there's no reason why shipping companies couldn't offer a budget version of my transatlantic trip. A sort of eco-friendly easy jet, with ships. Easy vessel, maybe. Captain Georgi is with me anyway.
I think it's possible, yes. If to make like a cheap variant, yeah, just to cross the ocean and then without any additional adventure. So it's possible, yes. I think so. But as I said, I never calculate, so I don't know. I just do the job what I know.
Well, even if container ship travel doesn't replace air travel anytime soon, this sure beats going on a big cruise liner. After all, who wants to be trapped aboard one of those things, full of sweaty tourists being entertained by bad magicians, when you could experience the camaraderie of a working sailor's life? This way, you have the whole ocean to yourself. Now I just have to survive 3 more days till we get back to Europe. I'm going back to the bridge for a coffee. This is Ben Knight, for DW, somewhere in the Atlantic Ocean.
As our ship docks, let's hit dry land and try another form of transportation. This time, we're going to hop on the back of a homemade bamboo bike. Bamboo is a natural material that is highly durable and can be used for building furniture, even housing material. But in Berlin, you can now make your own from this hardy little plant. Guy Dagan has more.
It sounds like soaring through wood, but bamboo is a grass, and while it's easy to cut, in its raw form, it's hard to imagine how long tubes of bamboo can be crafted into a proper roadworthy bicycle.
Bamboo is an amazing material. And just about all other aspects, it's like a steel frame. It's very durable. It's fairly light. It's quite stiff. You can make it quite stiff. But really, the property that just shines above all the rest is the comfort, the vibration-absorbing qualities of it.
Dan Fogel-Essex is one of the designers of Ortson Cyclery in Berlin. He's fascinated by bamboo and working with natural fibers.
There's a saying, steel is real. Everybody says, hey, steel is the material where you get the best ride quality. It rides the best. And I actually want to make a bumper sticker that says, bamboo is realer. I still want to have one.
In a small workspace located within an old railway yard, long strands of bamboo lie on overhead racks. A dozen or so handmade bamboo bike frames are in various stages of construction. Saws, sandpaper and epoxy resins line the workbenches, as well as bolts of natural fibre cloth, the tools and materials for working with bamboo. Together with design partner Stefan Brüning, Dan runs workshops for people who want to make their own bamboo bicycle. They made their first bamboo bike 3 years ago, but Stefan says it barely made it out of the workshop before breaking, and they've learned a lot since then.
There had not been a way how to do it available for everyone in the internet or any place where you could learn how to build a bamboo bike, so we had to figure out on our own, and this development was pretty interesting.
The pair found that tiger bamboo was a good species for producing bike tubes. The geometry of the frame is similar to any other type of bike. However, Dan and Stefan worked out that bamboo bike tubes need to have a diameter of 40 to 70 millimeters for best performance. That's much wider than standard bike tubes.
Diameter. You need the right diameter. That's of all the tests that we've done and all the different things that we've tried. The biggest problem with bamboo is that it tends to be flexible, which is also a benefit. And the super simple answer to making it stiff is just diameter. It's got to be wide.
Joining the tubes together is perhaps the biggest challenge for building a bamboo bike frame. And manufacturers differ in their approach. Some wrap tubes together with strips of hemp and epoxy resin, while others use steel joints. Bamboo draws its strength from the density of its outer and inner layers of fibres, so Dan and Stefan look towards other industries such as aeronautics to develop a way of joining bamboo together using flax fibre composite materials.
It's almost like, well, we're learning from nature. We're seeing what nature does. Nature makes tubing, which is pretty much perfect already, and we're trying to then join the tubing together. How do we make the joint as good as the tubing itself?
Well, all this sounds great, and the bikes look good too. But what happens if you crash your bamboo bike? Stefan says a bamboo tube might crack lengthways, but fixing it should be as simple as repairing a puncture.
You can always ride a bike when the tube is broken at any point. And also you can always repair these cracks because you can just add some epoxy in between and you can glue this together again quite easily. It's like, it's not going to break at the same point again.
On the day I visit the workshop, enthusiast Mark Brockman is carving fine grooves along the joints of his bamboo frame so natural fiber cloth and epoxy resin will bind properly. He's already put around 30 hours into building his new bike and is meticulous about its construction. And understandably so. The 42-year-old is a bike courier in Berlin and plans to use his bamboo bicycle for work.
I'm not getting any younger, and I think the comfort of the ride is better than an aluminium bike. I think there's more flexibility and absorption.
So, having seen how the bikes are made, I want to try a bamboo bicycle for myself to find out how a bike made of grass and glue travels on the road. I've just been riding the bike for a few minutes outside of the workshop, and my first impressions are that the frame feels stiff and it's very responsive as well. I've been going over cobblestones and some uneven terrain, and I must say that you do feel this dampening effect at work. It is quite a smooth ride. There's a growing demand for bamboo bicycles around the world, with small enterprises building frames in the US, Ghana, Zambia and Singapore. Dan Fogel Essex says he can see bamboo bicycles becoming more popular, but adds that bamboo is best suited to custom-made bicycles rather than mass production. Both he and Stefan Brüning hope that their frame-building techniques will be adopted by others. But for now, if you see a bamboo bicycle in Berlin, you'll know it's a special one, and it was probably made by the person riding it. For DW, this is Guy Deegan in Berlin.
And that's it for this edition of Living Planet. I'm your host, Saroja Coelho, and I'll be back again next week as we prepare to celebrate Biodiversity Day. We've got a wonderful documentary from Costa Rica about sloths that are living in a sanctuary. Our correspondent spent several weeks living in the rainforest and has some great stories to tell.
Linus came into us very young, and his mouth was, and still is, deformed. We don't know if it's a birth defect, if maybe he was sucking on his claws or heel in utero, but his mouth doesn't close all the way, which means he can't form suction.
This is Claire Trimmer, nursery supervisor at the Avario Sloth Sanctuary. Each morning, Trimmer weighs and feeds around half a dozen baby sloths. The nursery itself is an outdoor area where each animal is kept in its own spacious cage, equipped with blankets and stuffed toys for hugging.
Neither one of them likes anything but beans, but we always try to get one or two of these extra things in there. I am the food god. You shouldn't get the food god.
For some, feeding must be done by hand.
Whoop, you're dropping them.
I hope you'll join us. You can also find us online at www.dw.de/environment, or you can follow us on Twitter. That's at @DW_eco. So thanks for listening, and see you again next week.
Regular but never irrelevant.